But if you hire everybody with cultural fit, you end up with a monoculture. And that monoculture will kill creative ideas that go against the norm.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. As you know, we're always trying to uncover how innovators deliver disruptive concepts and products. How can we do a better job at thinking unconventionally? To that end, I decided to turn to Michael Wade. He's a professor of innovation and strategy at IMD and holds the Cisco Chair in Digital Business Transformation. He's published 9 books, more than 30 case studies, appears frequently in the mainstream media, and now he's the co-author of Alien Thinking, The Unconventional Path to Breakthrough Ideas, which hits bookshelves, digital and otherwise, March 16th, I believe. Mike, welcome to Future Proof.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's a great pleasure to be here.
I know I gave you a little bit of an intro, but in your own words, who are you and what do you do on a day-to-day basis?
You pretty much got it right in the intro. I'm a professor at a business school, but it's a business school that really focuses on executive education. So my students are managers and executives of companies. And what I spend most of my time doing is helping them understand the disruptions that are happening around them and how they can respond to them. The opportunities as well as the threats.
I want to jump into some of what you talk about in the book, because I think it's such an important topic these days. Everybody's trying to find ways to innovate and stay ahead of the pack, especially given how much change we're all living through. And we have a number of cognitive biases that keep us stuck in the same old school of thinking, well-worn patterns of thinking. So in layman's terms, what's an example of a cognitive bias? And also, how does it get in the way of true creative thinking?
That's a good question. There are literally hundreds of cognitive biases that social scientists have identified. Some of the most common ones are overconfidence, loss aversion, anchoring, confirmation bias. For maybe one example that we can most of us recognize is what the French call déformation professionnelle, which is basically the fact that we see the world through the lens of our professional experience. So lawyers tend to think in a similar way. IT people do the same, finance people, sales people, and so forth. In the book, Jeremy, we tell a story about Kellogg, the food company, trying to develop a healthier snack for school children. And so they went out and they knew they had to go and talk to key stakeholders. So they talked to parents, they talked to teachers, nutritionists, they even spent time talking to the kids. But there was nothing that really was working. They couldn't really get anything to work. And then they started talking to the janitors at the schools. This is certainly not a population that they immediately considered, but it turns out that janitors know exactly what the kids are eating. They know what's being traded, and they know what those kids are throwing away. So they eventually got the insights from that particular stakeholder group, but nobody had thought to ask their opinions before.
Yeah, it's interesting because I also think that there's a lot of in business, and tell me if you disagree, but a lot of looking at somebody else and trying to see what they're doing and then copying suit. And obviously, that's probably not the right path towards the most creative thinking.
No, but it's often the easiest path. If you're not sure what to do, just copy someone else. And it's not necessarily bad all the time. But if you really want to have a breakthrough idea or a breakthrough solution, you're not going to get there through copying.
Yeah. I also, as a fellow author, I got to say, I love that you found a way to create an acronym for the word alien. That's a true framework that actually makes sense. When I was writing, I tried and I just could not come across a really good way to develop a framework that was pronounceable. But so hats off in that regard. Can you walk us through those 5 key qualities, if you want to call them that, and how the 3 of you settled on those specific traits?
Sure. I think it is nice to have a acronym like that that people will remember. And it's not always easy to come up with them, as you say. Before I go through the 5 different elements of alien, let me just talk about maybe why we chose that metaphor. One of the big things we talk about in the book is the fact that you brought it up already. We have these cognitive biases. We're in many ways, we're slaves to our assumptions. Where we become blinded by our experiences. Wouldn't it be nice to see the world like an alien? If an alien comes down to Earth, they see everything with fresh eyes. And this is the idea. How can you see the world around you with fresh eyes that you're not blinded by your assumptions? So it's like the opposite of déjà vu, right? If you think of déjà vu is you see something and you feel like you've seen it before sometime in the past, but you're not sure where. That's deja vu. Imagine if you could, Jeremy, the opposite of that. What is the opposite of deja vu? Let's call it vuja de for the sake of argument. This is where you look at something that you see every day, but you see it as if you see it for the first time. And this is part of the challenge to moving beyond your blind spots. And that's why it's one of the reasons why we chose the metaphor of the alien to describe this new way of taking creative ideas and translating them into breakthrough solutions. So what are the different elements of aliens? So they all stand for something. So the first one, A, is attention. So this is around paying attention to the world around you. And there are different elements to that. There's zooming in, so you can really see things much more closely than you normally would. You're seeing patterns that you didn't otherwise see, but it's also zooming out. So seeing the bigger picture, trying to see the world from different angles, paying attention to extreme users, for example, adopting a different persona. Imagine what the world would look like if you're blind or if you're a child. So really trying to turbocharge this idea of attention that we become zombie-ish after a while. We don't really pay attention anymore to our worlds. So that's the A. And then the L is levitation. And levitation is about stepping back, taking time away, just like in sports, you take a timeout, kind of freshens your approach, and also stepping away, taking time off, time away, so that you can take a different perspective of what you're looking at.
Sorry to quickly interrupt. As I was going through these, I got to think that's maybe arguably to me the most difficult one that maybe businesses these days don't necessarily encourage as much as possible. So I don't know if you uncovered that in your research.
You're absolutely right. We're so busy with just doing stuff that we don't take those steps back. For an example, in business, now most people or many people have battery-powered toothbrushes, right? So they brush your teeth with one of these battery-powered toothbrushes. You probably have one in your home, Jeremy. And yet it wasn't one of the big giants who came up with this concept, right? If you look at Procter & Gamble, they had in their portfolio Oral-B making toothbrushes. They had Braun producing all kinds of devices. And they had Duracell. So they had all the pieces there. They just had to put them together. And they didn't because they couldn't step back enough to see the opportunity.
Yeah.
So then we've got to the A and the L. Now we get to the I, and the I is imagination. And imagination is really trying to connect the dots in creative ways. It's about being playful. George Bernard Shaw, the great playwright, you know, once said, "We don't stop playing because we grow old. We grow old because we stop playing." And I think that's true for many of us. We've lost our imaginations. It's like something we do when we're a kid, but then it's going to get beaten out of us. So using your imagination, making connections between really different things. It's like going back to the Medicis who were industrialists, but also they promoted artistry and music. And so getting all these inspirational people together and trying to gain insights from all these different areas. So really turbocharge your imagination. And then the E is experimentation. This is about test and learning, constantly going out there and not assuming you're done, going out and retesting and so forth, and avoiding the Segway trap. The Segway, this great, supposed to be the game-changing innovation. You remember that?
In air quotes, yeah.
Exactly. And it was a cool technology, but you know, I think they just fell in love with their ideas and they fell in love with their technologies and they didn't get enough user feedback. So experimentation is going out there, testing and learning, continually getting feedback, sometimes shocking people with things to try and get extreme responses because you can learn a lot from those things. And then finally, N is navigation. And that's a failure point for many innovators. They can come up with cool things, but then it just gets shot down. So it's navigating through the organizational context to try and get their creative ideas into breakthrough solutions.
And by the way, I think also that point to me is very interesting because I've met a lot of people and worked with people who are very good at navigation, and arguably they're not that great at the creative thinking or the fostering imagination and so on. And then I've also met people who are so incredibly, they've got these really great novel ideas. I'll have heard about that idea, and then 10 years later, somebody else implements it because that other person was just a much better navigator, selling the idea in, finding ways to overcome objections and all of that. So it seems like it's very difficult to marry those two together in the same individual or organization.
It is. And often you need a team. Often you need a team to do it. And as you say, this is a big failure point. This is where some of the methodologies that we see around innovation, like design thinking or lean startup, they don't spend enough time, I think, on this navigation piece. There's some very famous examples of this. The fact that James Dyson, even the fact that he called his innovation the bagless vacuum cleaner, stacked the odds against him. Because even that's a navigation error. You go into a big vacuum company like Black & Decker or Hoover or whatever, and you say, I've invented a bagless vacuum cleaner. They're already initially, right off the bat, going to be against your idea because you're challenging their fundamental business model. Call it something else. That's all part of the navigation. Or filmless photography is another one, right? Kodak was not that interested in getting into the idea of filmless photography, even though they developed the technology in-house. There's a lot around how to navigate.
I think that there's also, by the way, it could be that the incumbents, that's why naturally the innovation comes from a player who, like a secondary player, who isn't as invested in the old way of doing things.
That's true. Yes, that's true. Yeah. And so the challenge really for those incumbents, those big organizations, is to try and build a system internally where you don't kill those ideas.
Yeah, and I definitely want to talk to you a little bit more about how you set those things up for success. But I want to ask you, I think that what's interesting to me about the book is you're talking about looking at things as if you're an alien, but also championing the idea of embracing true outsiders. And it seems like most people, most organizations that I'm aware of, talk about the value of being an insider with a long track record. But why is it that so many breakthroughs, like the effective treatment of Ebola, as you talk about, are actually accomplished by outsiders?
Well, I think it comes back to what we discussed before. The outsiders will see things with fresh eyes. They'll bring in new experiences. They're maybe less afraid to fail. And so they do all those things. But it's not easy to be an alien. How many movies have you watched, Jeremy, where the aliens are the good guys, where you're rooting for the alien? So it's tough to be an alien. You come in and people naturally, they're suspicious of you. Maybe they don't trust you. So it's really not, it's not that easy. And so organizations have to do a lot more to attract people that are not like them. I think that this goes against, there's a maxim of business that's been around for a long time, says you hire people for cultural fit because you don't want people who go against your culture. That's fine. But if you hire everybody with cultural fit, you end up with a monoculture. And that monoculture will kill creative ideas that go against the norm. So you hire people that are not like you, but make sure you listen to them.
It's interesting because, as you know, we're talking, of course, during the middle of a pandemic still. And it seems to me that there are a lot of organizations that are struggling to digitally transform and to embrace change. And yet you want to find somebody that fits in your culture. But if you're a bit of a laggard in terms of technology, then it seems to me actually you need to create the type of incentive structure to embrace that alien, to not just hire them, but to make them feel comfortable in that environment so that they don't get chewed up and spit out, if you will, because how are you ever going to embrace change if you don't really incentivize that type of alien thinking?
Absolutely. I couldn't have said it better. I talked to someone just the other day, said they hired 10 really new outside innovative thinkers into the organization after a great deal of effort. After 9 months, 4 had left. So it's not only about attracting them, it's about retaining them. And that, because either one of two things happen, right? They get rejected by the organizational culture, or they get infected by it. If they get infected by it, they stop being creative and they stop being innovative and they're not aliens anymore. So that's, I think, the tricky thing for organizations is to maintain an environment that supports and encourages people to think creatively and think differently.
So since the name of the show is Future Proof, what evidence is there societally that we're getting better at thinking like outsiders and alien thinkers and that companies are you know, realizing that they need to embrace this type of thinking and promote and reward and incentivize that type of thinking from within?
I think what we're seeing with COVID is triggers of this happening, which is a good thing. For example, how many of your listeners work for companies where a year ago, the general feeling was, if you work from home, you're not really working. Real work happens in the office. That's very much ingrained. That's an assumption. This is very deep-seated in a lot of organizations. If you're not in the office, you're not really working. And that's changed in the last year. Many people are working from home, and a lot of companies are not bringing people back to the office. So there's these triggers, and I think COVID is a great trigger for that. So innovation can happen in these kind of, you know, disruptive moments. And so organizations hopefully are learning from that and seeing a world that can be quite different. And it's not just about doing the same things you were doing before in an office, but now in your home office. But there's other ways that you can change the way you operate and work as well. I think there's also, Jeremy, technology, digital technologies are opening up possibilities that didn't exist before or were a lot harder before that allow for more alien thinking. For example, before, if you wanted to pay attention to something, you'd have to physically go down there and watch. So Margaret Mead, the very famous anthropologist, I spent like 7 years in Papua New Guinea. Right? Now you can observe without actually watching. IoT, sensors, beacons, Reddit subgroups, like we've seen recently, social listening. You can actually learn a lot. You can pay attention to the world around you without having to spend the time or the expense to actually go out there and observe. There's a good example that we talk about in the book of the Toronto Raptors, my hometown, Toronto Raptors basketball team, where they, for practice, they put sensors in the jerseys. They weren't allowed to do it during games, so they did it during practices, just to see the movement of the players. And they found something very interesting. They found that about 40% of the time, the players are moving backwards, not forwards, not side to side, but backwards. This is something never thought about before. But because the sensors could give them this information, they never practiced, they never did drills backwards. They, in their strength training and flexibility training, they didn't spend a lot of time on the muscles that you use to go backwards. And so once they got this insight, they started spending a lot more time focusing on that. And one of the results was their injuries went way down the following season. So I think technologies can give you insights without biases, because we talked about cognitive biases earlier, when, you know, we're observing, we have these biases, whereas digital technologies tend to have fewer biases than humans do.
Although, of course, if we build that bias into, you know, the technology, that's a whole nother issue. That would be for a whole nother episode.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, I think that there are a lot of organizations out there that leverage the power of alien thinkers and promote outsiders. But then for every one organization that adheres to your advice, there are 5 or 10 who do not, and probably a few of them want to change the way that they think and the way that they promote and reward these people who are thinking a little bit differently. So how does somebody get from here to there? How does an organization move in the direction of alien thinking in general, but also just encouraging that type of behavior rather than disincentivizing it?
I think that's a great question. And it's true. I think you're right. Organizations, processes, structures, cultures, incentives are very efficient creativity killers. And what we found is that people want to innovate. They enjoy the creative process. They don't enter the workforce as zombies. They just get infected along the way. Like anything else, it's not going to happen just because you talk about it. It's not going to happen because you want it to happen. It's going to happen because you put in place, you change processes, you change incentives to promote more creative thinking, more innovative ideas. You put funding in to take those ideas forward. You allow people to carve out time during their day to think and reflect. Google's 20% time is probably the most extreme example of that, but doesn't have to be that extreme. You encourage people to block time in their agenda. This is one thing I would encourage all your listeners to do. Just 1 hour a week, block it in your agenda. This is my reflection time. And you don't put meeting there, that is your reflection time. And during the week, put a file on your computer or in your inbox, interesting stuff, call it interesting stuff, and then just toss stuff in there. Throughout the week, toss it in there. And then during that 1 hour, go through it. Give yourself a gift of time to actually be more creative. So I think there's things that organizations can do, big things, but also small things, everyday things.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because actually I want to surprise you with something that I'm just thinking of that's inspired by a previous interview that I did recently that might air before this, might air after. I was talking to somebody about publicly traded companies and how we report earnings every quarter. And does that promote some type of short-term thinking? Is there any type of solution to that so that organizations can think more creatively and think maybe a little bit more towards the long-term?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It also works. How many of your listeners have 3-year plans or 5-year plans? These are boxes that we put ourselves into. The world didn't exist that way. We created that way. Every 3 years, there's a process which takes weeks, sometimes months, to prepare these plans, and they get presented and they get approved, and then off you go. And the situation changes. Something changes along the way, which is inevitable. It's happening more and more now than it ever has before. And smart companies change. But the reality is they don't really change. And why don't they really change? It's because that budgeting process is linked to resources. It's linked to milestones. It's linked to the decisions that are made around funding. And those are really sticky. If you're in one of those planning cycles, whether it's a 3-year plan or a 3-month reporting cycle, that's ruling your world, and it's putting barriers up to being really creative.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And I think obviously the stock market is such that if you're publicly traded, you almost have to adhere to it. It's like a macro problem that the organization can't solve, but don't be more beholden to it than your competitors at the very least. And I think that this obviously ties into what you were already talking about, reflection, but what do you think about procrastination? Like, we've developed beliefs around procrastination as a society that it's purely evil, but it sounds that procrastination time, if you will, can be used for that reflection that you're talking about, and it doesn't have to be a sign of weakness, no?
Absolutely right, yeah. I think procrastination works on an inverted U distribution, meaning if you don't procrastinate at all, it's bad because you don't give yourself time to reflect and think. But if you procrastinate too much, that's not good either. But there's a sweet spot in the middle. The science is pretty clear on this, Jeremy, that deliberate procrastination actually helps with the unconscious thought process. Because even though you've moved on to do something else, your brain is still chuntering away. It's still thinking about it. It's still analyzing it. So you'll get better solutions after you've procrastinated for a while. We see that all the time. The problem is that the time we allow ourselves to procrastinate is getting a lot smaller because the world is moving a lot faster. If something happens, you hear about it right away. And once you hear about it right away, you're expected to respond to it right away. So there is very little time to procrastinate. So we need to give ourselves the benefit of a little bit of information float to give ourselves time to think and reflect and time out and, if necessary, procrastinate.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I was going to make a joke about us waiting until the night before this episode airs to edit it, but we tend to run a few weeks ahead of time. But this is great. I want to end on, I think, one slightly not related close point. So I know that you're the director of the Global Center for Digital Business Transformation. And I think that there's been obviously a lot of talk about what digital transformation is and what it isn't, especially in the last year. To you, how do you define digital transformation, and what have you seen in terms of how people have reacted, organizations have reacted to the pandemic in terms of digital acceleration? And also, how do you accelerate digitally when maybe your bottom line is hurting? So I guess a few parts to that.
Yeah, that's another part of my role. When I'm not thinking about innovation and creativity, I'm spending a lot of time thinking about digital transformation. So to answer your question, how do we define it? I think it's a good question because digital transformation is very buzzy right now. It's a huge buzzword. You ask 10 people, you're going to get 11 answers. So I think it is important to define it clearly. The way we define it is organizational change through the use of digital tools, technologies, and business models to improve performance. And there's some very important, I think, elements of that definition. The first thing is the goal. The goal of digital transformation should never be to become more digital. And yet that's exactly what we hear from many organizations. They tell us, we're old school, we're too analog, we need to be more digital. Can you help us? But that's the wrong, for us, that's completely the wrong objective. You don't want to become more digital. What you want is to improve your performance. And then you define how that is. Maybe it's market share. Maybe it's a top line. Maybe it's bottom line, whatever it is. But that should be your goal. And digital tools and technologies are merely an enabler. They're a means to that end. Because I'll tell you what, Jeremy, if your goal is to become more digital, all you need to do is throw lots of money at IT consulting companies, your own IT department, IT vendors, and they're smart. They will do it. They will make you more digital. But will it necessarily improve your performance is a lot less clear. So I think that's really important. The other thing is the organizational change part. Digital transformation, we've measured the success rate and it's 13%. So 87% of digital transformations fail. And one of the big reasons for that is because they don't treat it as an organizational change process. They treat it as an IT or a digital process. But I will say, and you brought it up in your question, that the pandemic has in many ways accelerated digital transformation in organizations today. So I think there's a lot of stuff that's going on at the moment. A lot of barriers have been removed. People are seeing the potential, and so they're going ahead. So I think that's a good thing.
I'm glad you ended on that, because initially I thought you were going to end on 87% of these initiatives fail. So we don't want to depress people too much, but I think it's wise to be a little bit aware of the challenges in order to pull these types of projects and initiatives off. And also the challenges associated with the thinking a little bit differently, thinking like an alien. I think it's obviously a great book and very timely. So I don't know when you started planning it out, but I think it's coming out at a time when a lot of people need it. Michael, thanks again. This was great.
It's my pleasure.
Thanks again to Mike for making the time. If you like what you just heard and this is your first time here, be sure to subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Stitcher, the choice is yours. And if you're a longtime listener, please remember to rate and review Futureproof, as that's the number one way we get the show in front of people just like you. Special thanks this week to associate producers Jason Stack and V. Cortuccio, and assistant producer Aaron Cohn. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Futureproof.